Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for this second week of February 2015. I'm Nan Evans, and my beat on Nature Now is the marine world around us. And I'm here today with Dave Rue. Dave is a wildlife biologist who has studied marine mammals since 1976, mostly whales of Alaska. Dave is now retired here in Port Townsend and is very closely involved with the Natural History Society and the Jefferson Land Trust. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you, Nan. I look forward to sharing some information on local marine mammals.
That'll be fun. Well, first, as always, we'll start with the mystery sound, and then later on the program, we'll let you know what it is. So here's a clue about that sound. You could hear the sound while you're walking on the beach around Port Townsend and East Jefferson County. So now let's see what is happening and what people have seen around town. Of course, spring is on the way. And we're all noticing the first signs of spring. Crocuses and other bulbs are poking their flowers up through the wet ground. I've even seen cherry trees in protected locations that are beginning to show buds. And those lucky locals who have cyclamen in their gardens are enjoying these lovely, delicate purple flowers. And the western chorus frogs have just started their singing in the woods around town. Ron Sykes saw four American goldfinch feeding on birch cones around Cotai Lagoon. Ron says that he has never seen goldfinches this early in the year before. And in his weather blog, Cliff Mass reports that temperatures now are about 1 to 1.5 months ahead of normal.
Kelly and Sue of Far Reaches Nursery wrote in saying that the weather has been so warm that they are finding northwest salamanders in the greenhouses and gardens. They are careful to not drag flats of plants when they move them around the greenhouses because the salamanders like to hide underneath the plants. Fred and Ann Weinman did an amphibian survey a few years back, and along with the expected frog egg masses, they found northwest salamander eggs. The salamanders use a wetland that runs alongside Hastings, out at Far Reaches, as a breeding area.
And I know Kelly and Sue do not use pesticides in growing their plants, so that really helps provide a great habitat for salamanders and other critters. Well, Kate Dwyer noticed that a number of red-winged blackbirds stayed around Cotai Lagoon this winter, rather than migrating south as they normally do. Ron Sykes with Admiralty Audubon observed that most of the non-migrating red-winged blackbirds are males and that their behavior seems to indicate that they are trying to preserve mating territories. Ron suggests that there may be more food available this winter, due in part to perhaps locals providing food in their backyard bird feeders, or perhaps just because it's been a relatively warm winter, it's easier to find foods.
That was the soft, throaty call of the small, mostly dark brant goose. Tom Butts with Admiralty Audubon recorded seeing about 150 brant.
That's a lot.
Feeding and loafing on the exposed gravel bars during low tide just offshore from Point Hudson.
You know, that's interesting. Earlier this winter, local birders noted that the brant were late in coming south from the Arctic lagoons where the brant spend the summers, and they were speculating that this was perhaps because the warming climate allowed a longer growing season than usual up in those lagoons in the far north, but I guess they've come down now. Well, now let's move on to our conversation with Dave Rue about marine mammals. I first met Dave a year or so ago when he was helping with the Jefferson Land Trust Natural History course. Dave gave an introduction to marine mammals of the Salish Sea. Chatting later that day with him, I remember oh so vividly his talking about doing aerial surveys of gray whales in Alaska and being able to count the whales by counting the muddy patches and the shallow nearshore waters where the whales were feeding. So, Dave, can you tell me a bit about the experience you've had studying marine mammals?
Sure. I have done research on marine mammals, mostly whales of Alaska, for about 35 years. I'm retired now, but my work has been through the National Marine Fisheries Service of NOAA, based in Seattle. 1 to 3 times a year, I'd go to Alaska for a few weeks or months at a time. The research involved standing on sea cliffs or sea ice, riding ships, or flying in small aircraft searching for whales.
Sounds like fun to me. I love that kind of stuff. So, Dave, can you remind listeners of the biologist's definition of a marine mammal?
Yeah, marine mammals are not really a taxonomic group. These are species that spent some of their evolution on land but eventually returned to the sea. Some have adapted completely to a life in water, such as whales and dolphins. Some live in the sea except when they mate and produce young, such as seals, sea lions, and elephant seals. On the other hand, polar bears are at sea most of their lives, but mostly on the surface of the sea ice. Sea otters are almost always in the shallow ocean waters, but they do occasionally rest on shore.
So those are things you think of as marine mammals. When I think of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the federal government, is that the group of species that act covers?
That's right.
Okay. And I know we talked about river otters on Nature Now last fall and made the point then that though you see river otters in the Salish Sea, they're not really marine mammals. Are there other mammalian species that live in the oceans but are not really considered marine mammals?
Yes, categorizing animals as marine mammals can lead to a bit of inconsistency if you look hard enough. For instance, the Arctic fox can spend most of its life on sea ice, similar to polar bears, but the Arctic fox is not treated as a marine mammal. Meanwhile, there are dolphins and seals that live in freshwater, never visiting marine waters, yet they are considered to be marine mammals. For instance, in the Baikal seal in Lake Baikal of Russia never gets to the ocean, and there are river dolphins in the Ganges of India.
Oh, and the Amazon, too.
And the Amazon, too.
So it sounds like, in a way, the edges of that definition are a little fuzzy.
They are fuzzy.
Yeah. I'm curious, how many species are there of marine mammals in the world?
Well, living now, there are about 88 species of cetaceans, that is, the whales and dolphins. There are 4 species of sirenians, those are the manatees and dugongs. There are 33 species of pinnipeds, which includes walruses, sea lions, and seals. And then add to that sea otters and polar bears.
And how many of these mammals are found in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, there are 7 species of cetaceans commonly found here. That includes gray whales, minke, humpbacks, Pacific white-sided dolphins, harbor porpoise, Dahl's porpoise, and, of course, killer whales. We also have lots of harbor seals, quite a few California sea lions, and a few stellar sea lions. Sea otters can be found on the outer coast. Once in a while, they come into the strait. However, we have no sirenians or wild polar bears, not even mermaids.
Dave, mermaids. Well, of course, we know mermaid is a mythological creature. The name comes from the Old English mare or sea and maid, a young girl. I find it really interesting that mermaids appear in the folklore of many cultures worldwide. We obviously think about the Greeks with the mermaids and the mythological sirens. Although there have been lots of so-called historical sightings of mermaids, and I know Christopher Columbus reported sighting mermaids in the Caribbean, that's usually just a misunderstood encounter with a marine mammal.
Yes, it kind of goes to lonely sailors looking at the sea. And when something like a monk seal, they used to be in the Caribbean, but they're extinct now, but those heads would rise up and they would fantasize it's a woman's head. And then the seal would dive and it looked like the fins, the backside of a seal.
So wishful thinking, you think?
Yeah.
Oh, fun. Back now to real marine mammals. Dave, can you tell me a bit about the research experiences you've had personally?
Well, I've flown aerial surveys along the Washington coast looking for sea otters. That was just shortly after reintroduced to the area.
Which was in the 70s?
That's right.
Okay.
as well as aerial surveys in the San Juan Islands looking for harbor porpoise. Also, I've been involved in clifftop observations of harbor porpoise near Shai Shai Beach on the outer coast. However, most of my work has been in Alaska. Every trip to Alaska has been an adventure, from camping in snow caves or igloos, riding across miles and miles of sea ice, sailing around the Chukchi Sea in a Russian ship retired from whaling, or flying in small aircraft low over the sea, twisting and turning to get whales directly below us so we can do vertical photography of them with bottom-mounted photogrammetric cameras.
So is the vertical photography so you can identify them as individuals, or?
That's right. Particularly, I've worked with bowheads, but when we look at the back of a whale, most of them have enough scarring and pigmentation that we can identify individuals.
Interesting, because clearly we know that there are individuals that you can identify on the orcas, but it's some of the things like scarring, and that's kind of human-induced.
Well,
or not.
There is human-induced in that some of the marks look a lot like a bullet has gone across the back of the whale. Not lethal, but it leaves a mark. The bowheads have about an inch of very thick black skin over blubber, which is white, and the skin gets cut. It's cut forever.
So it doesn't re-heal.
It has enough healing that there's no bleeding, but the white mark is there for a century or two.
It is a scar.
Yeah. But I think what's happening a lot with the bowheads is they turn upside down to feed off the rich bottom of the sea. When they are upside down, moving their backs along to catch stuff, they could bump into rocks and logs and such that cause scratches. Some of these scratches looks like a couple marks on a turn as a whale hits the bottom, turns up.
Now I'm trying to envision this. Why would a bowhead be turning upside down when it's feeding?
It's a bit of a problem for the bowhead. It has such a thin maxillae. The top of their head is very thin, a huge baleen, some of them 14 feet long, this big chin. But the bottom of the sea is so rich with food. It's the first few inches off the bottom. It's just rich with copepods and deposits. Well, how do you get that chin out of the way so you can feed? Well, turn upside down. Now the mouth is only inches from the bottom.
So it's sort of like a plow in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Curious.
And we, in the photographs, are often seeing mud all the way down their backs. That was my first cue to the whales probably turning upside down and hitting the bottom.
Oh, interesting. Do other whales do that sort of upside down thing?
No, gray whales go on their side.
Okay.
So it tends to be on their right side, and as they hit the bottom, they open their mouths and they cause plumes that the sea floor can open up a bit, and they suck in the prey from the bottom, so they come up dirty, and you can see the mud plumes as they rise to the surface.
Yeah, I mentioned that earlier.
That's right.
I was interested to hear about that. Now, I do have to ask you a question that's on my mind a lot lately, and that's about climate change. What concerns are there with respect to the marine mammals when we think about climate change? I mean, there's the classic thing about the ice melt and the polar bears having to swim more, and that tires them out and reduces their likelihood of survival. But what other things do you think about when you think about the impacts of climate change on marine mammals?
Well, the most dramatic changes will be in the Arctic, where the change is the most.
Sure.
And that's where we have ice-associated animals, particularly the seals and the polar bears. If they lose their platform, they're going to suffer.
Sure.
Walruses have been hauling out on shores where they haven't been forever, let's say, because they need the rest. Take away the ice, you take away their options for feeding. Not so bad for whales. The reverse is what we're seeing is there's less ice, the whales are expanding their range, which seems a good thing. So if we're kind of looking for the concern side of things, I would think because much vigor in the Arctic is where you have the ice front, that cold water drops down and causes a turnover. Which is invigorating to life. Take away the ice, you'll get more stratification and more stagnant seas. And there'd be less to eat.
And sort of less phytoplankton and zooplankton because you don't get that nutrient stirred up.
That's right. The vigor of the seas really helps to have the contrast of that ice and the warmer waters with the turnover.
To mix things up. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Dave, thanks so much. I think I could probably ask you questions for hours. But we do need to move on. First, let's hear that mystery sound again. That was the sound of the bluff collapse that happened in 2013 that brought down a large section of the bluff above North Beach at the end of Elmira Street. That's the area called the end of the world. Well, last week on Nature Now, Kate Dwyer read an amazing email from Jill Silver that, amongst other things, talked about the risk of bluff collapses and landslides from both natural and human-induced causes. And last week, as I walked the beach along the north side of Fort Worden and then west from the North Beach County Park, the signs of landslides down the bluffs were plentiful. And there is a huge boulder that's just hanging high in the cliff west of the county park. It's just waiting to come down. I sort of shudder about that. As I was walking, I then heard the sounds of shovels digging in the sand. And I rounded a small bend, and there were two young boys delightedly digging away at the toe of the sandy bluff. What were they thinking? I got my courage up and stopped and asked them if they had noticed all the slides around them. They had not. After explaining the danger they were putting themselves in and strongly suggesting that they stop digging, they did walk away. Disappointed, I'm sure. But that sort of reminds me, all of you out there, first, as Jill suggested, be careful and listen to the sounds around you. And second, don't increase the risks of those landslides or bluff collapse by digging, trying to climb up the bluffs, or doing otherwise fundamentally silly things. Let's look forward to upcoming events and what's coming up this week.
On Friday, February 13th, please join the Native Plant Society for their Elwha Dams and Lowlands Walk. This is a driving tour with several quarter of a half mile walk. The last of the Glynnes Canyon Dam is gone, and the Glynnes Canyon is in full view from the newly constructed overlook on Whiskey Bend Road. Find the local chapter's latest newsletter on the Native Plant Society of Washington's website for more information.
On Saturday, February the 14th, Valentine's Day, Admiralty Audubon is sponsoring a field trip along the Cape George section of the Larry Scott Trail. Check their website for details.
Carrie Clendeniel at the Jefferson Land Trust has put out an urgent call for volunteers to help decommission a mountain bike obstacle course that has sprung up at the Land Trust S-Curve Preserve along Chimicon Creek.
Ooh, in their preserve.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a mess. Oh. The obstacle course, which includes jumps, pits, ramps, and more, has significantly disturbed the plants and soils and presents a hazard to preserve visitors. Volunteers will be working on Monday, February 16th, from 10 until 1. Call Jefferson Land Trust for detail.
Boy, that sounds like an important volunteer opportunity to restore that.
Indeed.
Looking ahead, on February 27th and 28th, NOAA's National Weather Service and the University of Washington are sponsoring the Northwest Weather Workshop. It's in Seattle. And this would be a great workshop if you're interested in recent developments in weather forecasting and observational technologies, the major weather events of the past year, and other topics dealing with Western U.S. meteorology. The workshop is open to all interested parties and is, I understand, accessible. Laymen can understand what's going on, but pre-registration is required. Google Northwest Weather Workshop for details. That's it for this week on Nature Now. We hope you've enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news of the natural community where we live. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the website. Next week on Nature Now, Join Mary Robson and Bill Putney for a discussion about weather. That would be good background if you're at all thinking about the weather workshop. Nature Now is produced by Kate Dwyer, edited by Charlie Flashman, and production coordinator is Mike Schlexer.
Closing music is Sing a Whale Song, performed by Tom Chapin.
And swam out through the cove, then a race to the top, did a belly flop, and down again I dove. From the Arctic to the Baltic to the far-off Hebrides, like a submarine through the deep blue green. I swam the seven seas and sang a whale song. Sing a whale song. Sing a whale song. As the dogfish bark to the great white shark, sing a whale song. But there were some things I wish I could forget, like that garbage scow off of Curacao, or that oil spill below Brazil, or getting caught in that giant net, and I couldn't get out, and oh, was I upset. So I had to hail that magic whale who changed me back once more, saying, now that you know the great below, we need your help on shore. To tell your tale of being a whale and all you've seen and done, then wet and dry we'll unify, and all the world is one. We'll sing a whale song.